Is your mind wandering? I see people nodding. Mine certainly was. I was counting to 30. I was thinking about the noises I could hear, whether the air conditioning was on. Turned out I was hearing some static from the microphone instead, I think, or maybe the AC from nearby. And when I started meditating, I thought that the point of meditation was to be able to turn this off like a switch. That to be a real Zen student meant either thinking or not thinking, but never idly thinking. I thought I would have total control over when my mind would come and go. I spent about almost 15 years ago now, I spent a year at a monastery in Southern California where I meditated for many hours every day. And I tried so hard to train myself never to let my mind wander. The technique, if you can call it that, that I was applying at the time was to try to suppress thought. It's as if I were like holding down the lid of a boiling pot of water, trying to keep the thoughts down. Part of me was adding heat to the water, and part of me was holding the lid down. And guess which part always wins in the end? The lid always blows off. And at the end of a year of trying and failing to turn myself into some ideal thing, because that thing would not be a human, some ideal thing whose mind never wandered, I left the monastery so infuriated at myself and my mind and at Zen that it was years before I really practiced again. Like, you know, I showed right up to the Zendo as soon as I got out of the monastery, but I wasn't, I was phoning it in. It was years before I could really practice steadily again, because I first had to forgive. These days I think of mind wandering, I think of meditation much less as suppressing thought, like making something happen by effort. And it's much more like gardening. We talk about cultivating awareness, but then we don't cultivate it, we try to force it to be. But I've come to understand that it really is a cultivation. You can pot your awareness in good soil, give it some water, put it in sunlight, but the awareness grows, right? Like a plant. Keishin and I went plant shopping a couple weeks ago. It started me thinking along these lines. We've got a little New York City apartment with all of four windows and three of them face north, so we're not going to be growing tomatoes in our apartment anytime soon, but we wanted some plants that we could enjoy. Wow, somebody outside is really angry at somebody. Keishin and I, we'd actually had a couple of plants before this. We named them Hayden and Emerson because we thought it would be funny to name them as if we were ostentatious Brooklyn parents. You can imagine some like Park Slope dad shouting at his kids, "Hayden, stop hitting Emerson." But other than the names, there wasn't really very much fun about these plants. They're these like big, spiny, ugly plants. They never grew, they never died. We watered them, we didn't water them. It was like nothing had any effect on them. They might as well have been plastic. So we didn't really have the experience of gardening something. So we threw Hayden and Emerson in the compost heap in our basement and went shopping this month to get new plants that we would like. And we went to this really adorable shop on the Lower East Side. It's called The Sill. And it's on Hester and Allen Street. And it's adorable. It's this tiny little shop full of tiny little plants. And we got two new plants there that we really like. We named them Hayden and Emerson again. We're gonna pretend that the previous ones never were. Hayden in particular is really pretty. He's this thing called a nerve plant. It's called a Phytonia albivanus. Albivanus meaning white veins. He's got dark green leaves with this like filigree of white veins superimposed on it. He looks like a X-ray of a brain. And I think nerve plant is this wonderful name for him. The shop was staffed by two young women. I think they're Japanese American. They were having so much fun there. They were really enjoying that job because they spend all day potting little plants in little pots and spilling soil onto the counter and making little messes, sweeping up the little messes with a little broom, just all day long, make a mess, clean the mess. Just sounds ideal to me. And I think they were also really happy because they knew that most of the work that was happening in the shop was not theirs. The plants were growing by themselves. So the question is this what meditation feels like or no? Does it feel like awareness grows by itself and we just cultivate it? Or does it feel like we're trying to force something to grow? There's this whole field of Buddhist psychology called Abhidharma. It's a bunch of texts that were mostly written around like 400 or 500 AD, mostly in India, that categorize and split up and explain the mechanisms of the mind. The prominent author of Abhidharma is a monk named Vasubandhu, who came from a region called Gandhara, where Pakistan or Afghanistan is today. And he was writing around 400 AD. And he splits up the mind in a million different ways. One of them that I found useful is this idea of four layers of consciousness, which are mind consciousness, sense consciousness, store consciousness, and then self consciousness. The top layer, mind consciousness, think of this as the top layer of your garden where you can see the leaves and the flowers. And mind consciousness is where thinking and worrying and planning happen. They are the consciousness that we tend to think of when somebody says consciousness. It's thinking. Thich Nhat Hanh wrote a commentary on this, and he said that the brain is only 2% of the body's weight, but it consumes 20% of the body's energy. So using mind consciousness is very expensive. Thinking, worrying, and planning take a lot of energy. And not only that, right, that stuff is objectively so, but we add a judgment onto it in Zen. At least I do. I, for years, misinterpreted the teaching to mean that mind consciousness is bad. And I am trying to reduce the amount of time I spend there because it's bad. The layer below that is sense consciousness. And the Abhidharma kind of, it's very straightforward, but the Abhidharma kind of cuts it up a little bit more. It says that there is a organ of sense, like an eyeball. There's the object that's being sensed, like the sight of the floor. These make contact, and from this arises vision consciousness. And all of the other senses have this same kind of, these same components within the sense consciousness overall. And from the beginning, I've thought of sense consciousness as good. and that the project of meditation was to spend more time in sense consciousness and less time in mind consciousness. Think less, feel more. Or perceive more. And again, I think that this judgment is extra. I now think that this is a mistake, to judge these layers this way. Now you can think of mind as the thinking, senses as the stems, and then there's this wonderful idea of the store consciousness beneath. In Sanskrit, this is called alaya, and this is the dirt of our garden. All the seeds are down there in the dirt. The seeds of fear, anger, and ignorance are always down there, ready to spring forth the moment that they get watered, the moment that the circumstances are right for them to sprout, they come. The seeds of wisdom, compassion, awareness are also there. And if we cultivate them, they also grow tall and strong. But we can't make any of this happen, and neither can we remove any of these seeds. They're all always there. It's a question of how we cultivate them has downstream consequences in terms of which ones manifest or not into our actions and our thoughts. Now, there's this fourth layer called self-consciousness, and this is one I'm still having some trouble wrapping my head around. This idea that self-consciousness, the belief that we are separate, lasting, precious things that must be protected and promoted, this is a fourth thing. And Thich Nhat Hanh describes it as, imagine that a vine puts forth a shoot, and then the shoot turns back and embraces the dirt. In there, in the store consciousness, as a result of ignorance and fear, it gives rise to an energy that turns around and embraces store consciousness, makes it the object of its love. Right? It's sort of galloping, like precious. Right? All the dirt that makes me, everything about me that is in any way durable, this self-consciousness turns around and says, this is me and it's precious and it must be preserved. And again, I have come away from my initial training thinking that this was bad. And a lot of the descriptions make me sort of sound that way, like it's bad, it's twisted, it's neurotic. And the point of training is to like uproot this and throw it in the compost in the basement. But again, I don't think that this judgment is useful. All of these four layers are always there. To be human is to have a garden shaped like this. Eventually, like everything, it will fall away and rot and die. But while we've got it, let's not make ourselves suffer even more by saying thinking is bad, self-consciousness is bad, senses are good, let's spend more time in there. This is just the garden that we've got. Let's just cultivate it so that it grows more of the things that we want more of. Lately, I've been reading a lot of neuropsych papers about this really cool idea called the brain's default mode network, which is what your brain is running whenever it's not doing anything in particular. So the network is composed of like half a dozen different parts of the brain that all activate and connect to each other and pump a bunch of blood whenever you're not using your brain to accomplish a particular task. So the parts of the brain involved are mostly associated with, I had them written down here, right. Thinking about ourselves, remembering autobiographical information like facts about our lives, thinking about other people, thinking about relationships, planning and forecasting. So simulate what we think is going to happen. Does this sound familiar? This is that top layer. This is thinking, worrying, and planning. Now, when we're accomplishing a task, the parts of our brain that are mostly associated with that task mostly activate. So if I'm like trying to pick a friend's face out of a crowd, then maybe my visual and spatial systems and facial recognition subsystem are all lighting up. But then researchers find that within half a second of completing a task, the activation pattern switches and we go back into default mode. And this is not, I think, a surprise to any of us. We experience default mode activation as mind wandering. And I certainly know that my mind can begin to wander within less than a second of my completing some task. It reminds me of an experience when I first meditated at Sing Sing. This was many years ago. I visited there for the first time with Ryotan, and we went down into the little room that we use as a zendo there, and I was looking around at the men there, you know, mostly big guys who have been in Sing Sing and working out every day for many years, and I knew also why they were there, mostly drugs, violence, murder. And I was thinking, this is a pretty incredible place to do zazen. No guard around, right? Just us and these felons. And then for the next period, I daydreamed. And when I caught myself, I thought, this is really messed up that under circumstances like these, I choose to daydream. There's got to be something wrong with me. But I really don't think so. You know, we vary, but I think all humans to some degree check out a lot. Researchers have noticed two big fluctuations in our attention that are associated with the default mode network. One of them is that we connect and disconnect from our senses. So I might be walking down the street, I'm aware of the buildings, I'm aware of the noises, and then I disconnect and I have what they're calling stimulus-independent thoughts. It does not matter where I am or what I have witnessed, I'm just thinking about something. Probably a continuation of the conversation I had when I last checked out a few minutes before. And this disconnection is very real. Like if you're, they've got a study where you have to read for 45 minutes and they measure the rate at which your eyes are scanning the page. And when you're reading, the eyes speed up and slow down. So you spend more time looking at an unfamiliar word or a complex sentence. And then a few minutes in, you check out and your eyes just start moving perfectly evenly. So the experience you have when you catch yourself later on and you've been reading without seeing the words is very literally true. At some point, you come back. And you can either come back because you realized your mind was wandering, or you might just come back. I'm not sure whether we can come back without knowing that we were our minds were wandering or not. I think we can. If researchers interrupt subjects and say, "Is your mind wandering?" people can accurately say yes. But that doesn't mean that we are able to catch ourselves if somebody doesn't ask from outside. And we know this to be true. We are not in control when we begin wandering. There are theories as to why, that the executive function that chooses to use the mind in one way or another gets recruited into the default mode network, and so it's doing other things. It's participating in the thinking, planning, and worrying, so it's not available to catch us. And that might be the reason, or it might not. Like, I don't want to sort of oversell neuropsych, you know? what we've discovered about ourselves from sitting and facing the wall, what Buddhist teachers have been investigating for thousands of years, is no less factual than this neuropsych recent research. Neuropsych gives us another way of speaking and another method, but don't let it kind of confuse you. What you know about yourself is just as true and just as untrue. So thinking and planning and worrying, it's always growing in our garden. It's a probably innate part of being human. And I think that everybody does it. And it's not bad, right? Certainly a lot of my best ideas have come in the shower. I'm glad that my mind wanders. I don't think I'd be very creative if I never daydreamed. But we do it too much, and we don't have enough intention about when our minds are wandering and when they aren't. So I do think that there's a few things that we can do to kind of master our mind wandering rather than letting it master us. One of them is that when we have an opportunity to let our minds wander, we should take it. And lately it's become particularly epidemic, an epidemic of people not letting their minds wander, right? I do this too. I check my phone when I'm waiting for the elevator. I listen to a podcast while I'm doing the dishes. But I am trying to be much more conscious about this would be a good opportunity to daydream. I'm going to take it. Because I think that mind wandering is kind of like sleeping. We don't know why, but we do need it. And if we don't let ourselves have it, it will happen, right? You can't decide that you're a Zen student, that means you don't sleep anymore. You will fall asleep. And you also can't decide that your mind is going to stop wandering. You will experience a lapse of attention sooner or later, so it's probably a good idea to set aside time for it, okay? We can't always be either on task or in some incredible state of mindfulness where we're only in sense consciousness. There's a whole other portion of our lives where our minds are wandering. We are disconnected from our senses and we are off in the clouds. And we have to accept that that is part of being alive. Researchers had this sort of annoying sounding study where subjects carried apps around that randomly interrupted them and said, "Is your mind wandering?" as they went about their days. And yeah, it's about 50%. Paul Simon has a lyric, "Half of the time we're gone and we don't know where." And it's funny because he estimated, he published that song in the 60s. That was his estimate and turns out to be remarkably accurate. So one thing is let your mind wander when it's a good time. Another is meditate. Again, it comes as no surprise. Our own research has already confirmed this fact. If you spend years training yourself to be aware, your mind wanders less and you have more choice. People who have meditated are able to keep their minds on task for longer periods. And then the last thing is, set aside a time to cultivate awareness in your garden. Sesshin is designed for this purpose. Sesshin is the dirt and the water and the sunlight to allow your awareness to grow strong. At the end of a week of sesshin, my mind wanders certainly much less. And you can see why. Like, I don't have to plan anything because all the days are the same. I don't have to think about myself and others because I'm not interacting. I'm not checking my email, I'm not reading, I'm not watching TV, so there's nothing to process, right? And this naturally allows awareness to grow big and strong. And then you have to repot it in your ordinary life, when you come back. And that's not easy, but giving the plant a chance to grow in ideal circumstances is still worthwhile. So keep this in mind, all right? Let's relax our judgment about whether mind wandering is good or bad, okay? Let's make space for it, and let's understand that cultivating awareness is not forcing something to be. It's creating the circumstances in which it will grow. If you do this, I have faith for all of us that will grow big, strong nerve plants.